Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, January the 10th, 2014. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Jackie McIntosh.
Hi.
And Cynthia Ganatra.
Hello.
And plus we have Tim on the controls.
Hi there.
Alyssa and Jenny are away today. Welcome, everyone. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living, broadcasting live every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and bringing you interviews, commentary, news, and events that you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and abroad. We encourage the movement toward a world where non-human animals are treated with compassion and mercy and afforded the basic right to live free from exploitation. In addition to our live broadcast here on 100.5 FM and at cooperadio.org, our shows are also available as podcasts on iTunes and at animalvoices.org after airing. On today's special show, we have a mishmash of topics to present to you. Our first main topic is called The Dirty on Down. And from that title, you might guess that there is something unscrupulous happening in the production of down and feathers that go into filling our winter jackets to keep us warm during these cold temperatures, as well as comforters and pillows. I really wanted to investigate what this whole process is all about, and so today we will be presenting to you all the info you need to be an informed consumer when it comes to knowing what goes on into these products and how they are made. We'll be also discussing, of course, alternatives to animal cruelty when it comes to keeping warm in the winter months. And for our second main segment, we have an unusual interview for you. We'll be speaking with Dr. Jennifer Mather, who is a researcher of and expert on the cephalopods known as octopuses. I had read an article recently about some of the findings on these mysterious creatures of the ocean and was surprised to learn that some of their cognitive abilities that we humans would be quite impressed with, I think. And not only that, octopuses are unique sea-dwelling creatures in other ways, but yet we know so little about them. So Jennifer is here today to unravel some of the mysteries of the lives of octopuses and will be telling us about some of the surprising skills and behaviors of intelligence that they demonstrate. This interview is coming up in 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned for that. But first, both Jackie and I were busy this past week with doing some vegan outreach in the public, so we're going to talk a bit about that. Jackie, you're helping out at a brand new vegan info table last week on the street, Robson Street, very busy in downtown Vancouver, which I understand is going to become a regular thing happening there every weekend. So please tell us about that.
Yeah, so I have to give credit for that to Stacia Lays, who organized it. So she was just an activist, not associated with any particular group, and she wanted to just do some outreach downtown, basically with that in mind, that we're not associated with any groups. We're all just getting together, a bunch of activists, to do some outreach. The vegan outreach or the vegan info booth was set up at the Vancouver Art Gallery on Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m., but we stayed actually quite a bit later and started a bit late as well. But regardless, it was great to be there. Initially, it seemed like mostly vegans or vegetarians were approaching the booth, which was good that the vegetarians were, because we were able to provide outreach to them. And for the vegans, we were able to give them some local resources, which was also good. What we found over time, though, is a lot of people were just kind of walking by, not necessarily so interested in coming to the booth initially.
Did you have a sign there that said
we did have
info?
A sign, exactly. Okay. So we started to do leafleting and just encouraging people to get into conversations and to just engage with us. And overall, I think it went really well. It's kind of what you would expect for that area. We had a lot of, you know, people that weren't necessarily as present as you would expect. They were on their phones. They were trying to get from one place to the next. But regardless, we did have some great interactions in that time.
Yeah, regardless of the people that weren't available to speak with you, it's such a highly trafficked area, especially on a Saturday, that it's the perfect area for people who don't live in Vancouver. It's like the hub of downtown Vancouver, where there's so many people passing by. So yeah. I think it was a really great spot to have that there. And definitely, like, did you find you were having interesting conversations with people and people that really, like, what were some of the conversations like?
Well, there was a couple people that were vegetarians, and they stopped by, and they were kind of just curious. Yeah. Well, I'm vegetarian, but I don't know what's wrong with dairy, and like, why go vegan? And so those were some of the really good conversations, because a lot of them had just no idea on what goes on in the dairy industry, and they were just shocked. So hopefully we change some minds that way, at least.
And, you know, even being present for that reason alone, I think, makes it really worth it. And I had sort of the same experience with the outreach that I did yesterday. I helped with a pay-per-view display at the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia yesterday. They're actually doing it throughout this week, on Tuesday, yesterday, Thursday, and today. And it's being run by the Student Environment Center as a new initiative by them. So for people who are not familiar with the pay-per-view concept, the idea of this project is that you offer people, usually it's like $1, to watch a short video on factory farming issues, which is often the first time that people are ever subjected and learn about this, what goes on in factory farms and how your meat is produced. So it's a good way to sort of engage them because they get paid. However, we paid them with brownies, vegan brownies this time. And I think that's even way more of a brilliant idea, because what I understand is what people have done in the past is that they've actually have given back the $1 because they kind of feel bad, like, oh, like I learned something. But I think it's like, I want to feed people delicious brownies, and to sort of, when we are engaging them in conversation after they watch the video, and every single one of them engaged with me, like I asked them, what did you think? Did you learn anything new? And I had a good conversation with every single person, and I didn't want to keep them too long, but I think definitely it was some food for thought for them. They had just watched this really powerful video of what goes on in factory farming, which information that they may have never known before. Some of them said they did know this information before, and like, oh, I've seen documentaries. So I would engage them in that way, like, oh, what documentaries have you seen? And okay, so, you know, does learning more about these issues make you want to sort of change your lifestyle and your eating habits? And some people, you know, very honest conversations like, well, I have these challenges, or, you know, I don't know what to buy, or I'd say, well, there's so many different, you know, like meat analog products on the market. If you really like meat, or if you don't know sort of how to, or look at this book here, I can give you a vegetarian starter kit. There's recipes. They were all willing to accept this information. And that's why I like doing it at the university, because I just find that the people there are they're very receptive. So maybe more so than downtown, where it's harder to get people.
I think the college university crowd generally tend to be a bit more perceptive to the message. Yeah.
So that was really, I found it was really worth it. I had asked the organizer how many brownies he had given away the day before, since we weren't finished yesterday, but I was only there for an hour, and I spoke to maybe almost around 20 people came through the booth. We had 4 laptops set up, and they were pretty actively being used throughout, so maybe even more than that. But he said that the previous day that it had been done, 80 brownies were given out. So that's 80 people, 80 people that we educated. So, yeah, that was very useful.
Jam number 2, a tribute to New York City from Mambo to Hip Hop. I'm coolin' in New York, I'm chillin' in New York. The hoods is on my block and the brothers at the court. The baseball hats is on and the projects is calm. Dream time's extended. Featuring special guest DJ Evo, the hostess with the mostest, Kim Immortal on the mic, and resident DJ selector, Mr. Taddy. Music from New York, music about New York, music that was big in New York. Again, that's Friday, January 17th at Calabash, 428 Carroll Street. Fam Jam number 2, a tribute to New York City from Mambo to Hip Hop. $8 at the door. Follow Vancouver Groove Movement at Van Groove Move on Twitter or Instagram. Can I kick it?
So you are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, downtown Eastside, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And so for events coming up, we have the 2014 Northwest Speaking Tour with Rod Coronado, January 30th to February 2nd. Rod Coronado is an eco-activist and animal rights activist. So in January, February, the Hunt Saboteurs and Resistance Ecology will be holding a speaking tour with Rod Coronado. They're asking for donations at the door to help with the cost of the tour, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. Anyone planning to video or record the presentations, please make that known and get it cleared first. This tour is to raise awareness of the wolf hunts, hunt saboteurs, and other topics happening now. There's events all over the U.S., but there's only two that currently have the locations listed. So I'll just list those. There's one on Friday, January 31st in Seattle at 7 p.m. at the Black Coffee Co-op. And then there's one Saturday, February 1st in Portland, Oregon, 7 p.m. And it says at the PSU room number 238. And also, there is the weekly events, Fantastic Friday Nights at Sun Suiwa Restaurant. Please join Vancouver Animal Defense League to protest the shark fin soup. 100 million sharks are killed annually for the delicacy to the point that many are endangered. This event takes place from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And again, that's at Sun Suiwa Restaurant, which is at Main and East 23rd Street in Vancouver.
Can I say something about that? Mm-hmm. I was standing on the corner of Granville and Broadway to cross the street before Christmas, doing some Christmas shopping. And on the post there, I saw a sign that said boycott Sun Suiwa. It's like, oh, good. I know all about
yeah,
that.
I think they've been posturing. Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Good. And yeah, next Tuesday, the 14th, at 6:30 p.m. at Eternal Abundance, Alyssa and I will be hosting our bi-weekly support circle. So we'll be discussing the new year and all the things that come along with it, new goals, aspirations, or just a fresh start and challenges that go along with it. And this is the group for the regulars. So yeah, if you want to become a regular part of this project, please join us.
I'm going to try to be there. For the first time, I'm going to try to become a regular.
That would be great.
I think it's a really useful initiative.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been a few times, and it's a great... Great.
How many people do you have going? About a dozen every time?
It's usually about a dozen, like 10 to 12, depending. But we're trying to get a core group, and then we're also going to have the drop-ins.
And Eternal Abundance is a really lovely place to meet.
Exactly.
Really nice food and nice atmosphere there.
Yeah, so it's great to support them as well. And coming up for Valentine's Day, Animal Voices is teaming with Drishti Point in the name of community building and outreach. We'll be presenting a series of events around Valentine's Day that celebrate compassion for all beings. Please join us for any of the events, and I'll just list them off for you. So Thursday, February 13th, we will have a vegan bake sale, which is at the Unity Yoga and Tea House from 4 to 7 p.m. Bring your own container for cookies, cupcakes, and more. And also, we are still looking for bakers for this event. So please email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com if you feel like you'd like to contribute some baking to this event. And on Saturday, February 15th, there is Cultivating Compassion Yoga Workshop. And that is going to be hosted by Cynthia Ganatra. Our
Which is
own.
Me.
Hi, Cynthia.
and Farah Nazarelli of Drishti Point. So that will be a sliding scale event from $20 to $40. It's a three-hour workshop that will include asana, film clips, discussion, and dialogue reflection about how we can contribute to health and happiness of all sentient beings. And then on Friday, February 14th, will be our free film screening of Speciesism, the movie. I believe that's the first filming in Vancouver, so that's...
It is. It's the premiere in our city.
So very exciting. So don't miss that. And that's at the SFU Harbor Center from 7 to 9 p.m. And there'll be a pre-film raffle starting at 7. And that will be in room 1900 Fletcher Theater. And that is by donation, so no one is turned away. Like we said, it's free, but if you can donate, that would be great.
Yeah, just a little bit about that film. I don't think either of you have seen it yet, right?
No.
But you will soon. So it's a really interesting documentary that follows around a filmmaker who is just learning about the issues that concerned with factory farming for the very first time. And that's why he decides to make a documentary about it. And he really does some really in-depth research by interviewing some of the major lead people in the animal rights and animal welfare movements, including Peter Singer and Bruce Friedrich and just lots of other people. And then he goes and does investigations into how our food comes to us. So it's really interesting. And it's funny, too. It's really, really funny, which I think really keeps it moving along.
Great. Yeah, I hope to see all of our listeners there. And if you have an event to share on our show, please email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
Thank you, Jackie. Well, I've had something on my mind a lot this winter, and it's the issue of down. With all the cold weather we've been getting in recent months, what's one to do when you want a warm, puffy, weather-resistant jacket to keep you as toasty and insulated as our feathered friends, the birds, are naturally in these types of freezing temperatures? What does a feeble human being like me do to stay warm when I have major concerns about how such down jackets are produced in a market where I'm finding that all of these jackets that I want are filled with feathers, but yet I know that these feathers are probably not humanely obtained. So I really wanted to get educated on the subject to be able to make some sound decisions when it comes to choosing my outer winter wear, and I will be telling you what I have discovered. The question is, are animals harmed in the down industry? Is there cruelty in your down jacket or feathered filled comforters and pillows? So first of all, what is down, Jackie and Cynthia? Do you know what the difference is between down and feathers?
No. Putting you on. I thought they're the same.
Yeah, they are.
Well, it's a bit of a trick question because the down is feathers, but they are the fluffy quillless feathers, you know, like those really soft feathers that from the breast of a goose or a duck, they're located under the outer layer of the hard quilled feathers, which would be like the what everyone associates as being feathers. The down is the fluffy stuff. Technically, it's got feathers. Down feathers act as a natural thermal vest for birds by trapping air and preventing the loss of body heat, which is exactly why they are so popular with humans for keeping warm. We humans have, as usual, taken what works well in nature and adapted it for our own needs. So next question, how is this down obtained? Well, I think the average unsuspecting person might believe that down is procured by benign means, such as being naturally shed by the ducks and geese in their comfortable barns where they comfortably live on the farm, and then the farmers kindly gather it from the floor and send it to the jacket making factories to produce into these fabulous and stylish down jackets. What do you think? Is that an accurate depiction as far as you think people might?
That's what the children's storybooks depict, so it must be.
Yeah, there's probably I got that out of a children's storybook, right? Well, I do think that many animal derived products that people use, like many animal derived products, most people really have no idea of what the procurement process involves, or if they do, it's not a very accurate depiction. Like most animal use industries, this information isn't advertised to consumers in the media, which thus leaves the gap open for people to be left in the dark when it comes to knowing where their products come from. So it turns out that much of the down used in jackets is a byproduct of the meat industry. Makes sense, right? It is plucked from the birds after they are slaughtered for their meat. And that also includes foie gras, which is the French term for fatty liver, in case you didn't know. And it is just that. It's a delicacy that people eat. It's produced by cruelly force-feeding ducks so that their livers swell to 10 times their normal size. And then the ducks are killed and the diseased fatty livers are eaten by people. And the feathers are plucked from the slaughtered birds and are sent to the down industry. Of course, whether it's foie gras or just regular duck meat, we know that the slaughter process is a terrible ordeal as well. So these animals are suffering immensely prior to the time where the feathers are gathered post-mortem. But that is not all. An issue that is not largely known about, but is quite prevalent, is that many geese are actually plucked while they are still alive. And this seems to be a dirty little secret that the down industry claims is a rare occurrence. However, in 2009, a Swedish news program conducted an undercover investigation where this practice was shown, and the video footage is not pretty. We have here a short audio clip describing what is being done to the animals.
The cruelty behind every down-filled product is chilling. Many birds used for down have their feathers yanked out of their skin, sometimes several times a year, while they are still alive. The terrified birds are pinned down while hurried workers pull fistfuls of feathers from their sensitive bodies, often plucking them so violently that they rip open the bird's skin, Workers sew up the wounds using a needle and thread without giving the birds any painkillers.
I've posted the entirety of this clip with accompanying video on our website so that you can see it for yourself and you can see how the geese are live plucked. You can watch it on our site at animalvoices.org on today's show. Show posting that's for January 10th, 2014. A veterinarian with the SPCA likened it to being just like pulling out a clump of hair. Sounds fun, huh? And she said it was definitely torture. In fact, if you see the videos yourself, the video yourselves, you can witness these poor birds even being sewn up almost viciously. Did you see that, Cynthia?
I did.
What were your impressions?
I've seen that actually before, but just seeing it again was just horrific. It just
and the reason why I included that audio track there is you can hear like it's showing the animals being plucked. It looks really, really harmful. They're so big gashes in their skin, they're bleeding, and they're being just really like viciously just sewn up really quickly with these big needles and thread. No anesthetic, of course, that would cost money and time, right? There's no time for the workers to take any care other than just doing a really rough and quick job. And then these animals are left with no feathers too. They need those feathers, right? There's a reason that birds have feathers. And I just can't even imagine how painful that would be. So put yourself in the place of these birds is what I always say is, would you want something like this happening to you?
Well, there's a reason that birds are born with feathers and we are not. So maybe they should stay on their original owner.
Good point.
Right. But I guess this is all about is humans do need warmth and we have to adapt. So we'll be talking a little bit about that later. Like, what do you do and not inflict cruelty on other animals? So like I said, the down industry claims that live plucking only occurs in very small numbers, that 1-2% of all down obtained is live plucked, they say. It has been outlawed in the United States as far as I have read and in several European countries as well. However, it still happens in countries like China, Poland, and Hungary. Hungary is the main exporter of down to the UK, and China exports 80% of the world's down and feathers. So the 1-2% of admitted live plucking by the industry is a bit of a con, says Marcus Mueller, who was an investigator working for many years to expose the cruelty of the industry. He says that only geese are live plucked, but the industry includes ducks in this figure as well. So that diminishes the percentage of live plucking when you include all the factory farmed animals, the ducks who are plucked after slaughter, all those ducks for meat and foie gras. It, however, doesn't diminish the pain for the millions of live plucked geese. It takes feathers from how many geese do you think to make a down-filled jacket?
Like 100?
20?
A jacket. 3 to 4.
Wow.
So, and one goose to fill a pillow. So, yeah, imagine all the billions. So, you know how many pillows and jackets and comforters there are in the world? Imagine all the billions of feather-filled jackets and pillows out there in the world that translates into a grotesque enormity of cruelty being inflicted upon these creatures as fast as jackets and pillows can be mass produced, of course. The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, who have done investigations on this issue, have estimated that as much as 50% of all down plucked in Hungary is live plucked. And for the manufacturers and retailers that this down is sold to, how are they going to know that the down hasn't been live plucked if they happen to have a policy of not purchasing live plucked down, as some of them actually do? Well, they don't know, because how can they know exactly if the down that they are buying hasn't been plucked from live birds unless they are witnessing it themselves and then seeing that particular down shipped straight to them? The fact is that the whole process of the industry is really very complex. Down is procured from different farms and it's sent to buyers and processors and then on to suppliers and manufacturers before it gets into the consumer's jacket. It's a complex system that would be impossible to keep track track of when it comes to finding the origins of down. The Swedish news program in 2009 reported that 50 to 80% of the world's down market comes from live plucked birds. That was then also proven by the store IKEA, who they did an independent investigation themselves because they wanted to know where the down in their products were coming from. And that alone is just, it's an astonishing figure, 50 to 80% of the world's down market. And if it matters to you that the down in your jacket was plucked from live birds as opposed to from dead birds, then it's safe to assume that it was, since you know that there is at least a 50% chance that it was. And of course, there's no way of knowing 100% that it wasn't. So just on the topic of live plucking, you might be wondering why the down feathers are obtained this way. Well, it all comes down to money, of course. It's done because it's profitable. Instead of just being able to pluck a goose once when he or she is dead, if you keep him or her alive, you can do it several times and thus maximize your profits. And it takes about 5 weeks for the down to grow back, and that is when the goose is ready to suffer the torture of being plucked again. So what is the bottom line? What it comes down to is if you buy down, you're supporting an industry of animal cruelty, even if the down is a byproduct of the meat industry, which is, of course, very cruel in itself. However, there are alternatives to buying jackets, and you know, we wouldn't be living in the world that we are and being comfortable with warm jackets as vegans if we couldn't have alternatives, right? So Cynthia, you're going to tell us about some of these down alternatives.
Yeah, there's many alternatives, so I'm just going to talk about a few of the top ones, but I got a lot of these from onegreenplanet.org, which has a great blog about what alternatives to down. So one of them is Primaloft. This patented synthetic microfiber thermal insulation was originally developed for the U.S. military. So the goal was to develop a material that, unlike down, would not lose its insulation when wet, but retain the lightness, softness, suppleness, and compressibility found with down insulation. So this jacket is water-resistant, lightweight, very soft, and highly packable. So it is better than a down jacket. Primaloft is the number one leader in synthetic insulation, and you can find it in companies such as North Face, Patagonia, and ethical vegan fashion house Vote Couture. So check out Primaloft. There's also Omniheat. This is a Columbia Sportswear proprietary brand, so you'll only find it in Columbia Sportswear. And just be careful, because not all jackets with Omniheat are free of animal products. So, of course, we know that.
Reading labels is important.
Exactly. So just because it's filled with a synthetic fiber, you also want to make sure that it is a complete vegan jacket, if that's, you know, what obviously we're looking for. And then there's this other great one called Kokona Insulation. So this is by Naus, which I've never heard of, but Naus is spelled N-A-U-S. And it's rather unique because it's made of lightweight and breathable fiber that is crafted from coconut husk waste that's been discarded by the food industry.
So all that coconut water I drink has use for right now, which is great to know.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So that's a really neat one. So if you can find that in your area. And then the last one I'm going to mention, which is one of my favorites, and I'm hoping to get a coat next year or when they have a huge sale, which is the Hoodlam. So Hemp Hoodlam is from the Netherlands, and all their products are not only vegan, but at the produced. They have collections for women, men, and even children. Their winter gear sports a special Satifur lining. Satifur is Hemp Hoodlum's own invention and is made of hemp, recycled plastic, and acrylic. And our lovely co-host Jackie has a Hemp Hoodlum coat, which I love. And tell us about your coat. How is it?
It's very warm. Like, it's so, even in like the cold winter that we've been having, like it's really warm. Like, I can wear a t-shirt underneath and still be nice and toasty. So yeah, it's good.
So these are great alternatives. It's certainly possible to find something out there.
And there's way more as well.
Yeah. What I have found, though, is that I looked at a couple of those jackets. They're $350. So what are some alternatives if you just don't have any money? I've been personally looking in thrift stores. I haven't found anything yet, because that's sort of like, you're taking your chances to find something you like, something that fits
you. Yeah. Well, look for sales. Like Jackie said, she got hers for over 100.
I think it was like 150 or something. Yeah.
So yeah, as far as jackets go, that's a pretty fair price. I think that's going to last a long time. Mm-hmm. And so I hope this segment will help you make some informed choices the next time it comes to buying a traditionally feathered filled product, such as a jacket or comforter or pillow.
You are listening to Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio in downtown Eastside Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish territories. So some news. Bear watching, more profitable than bear hunting, says study. So environmental group is calling for the BC government to change its policy on bear hunting on the North Coast. Surprisingly to them, there's more money in looking at bears than there is at shooting at them. 12 times more to be exact. The study was actually conducted by a research institute at Stanford University and funded by a conservation organization called Tides Canada. And they concluded that bear-related ecotourism is exponentially more profitable than trophy hunting. They found that bear viewing generates 12 times more visitor spending than bear hunting and over 11 times more direct revenue. And so ecotourism, like bear viewing, has grown rapidly over the last little while, which I think is amazing because obviously we do not want bear hunting. And just even, fortunately, they're just talking about economy here. But when they're talking about jobs, they said there was 510 jobs for bear watching and 11 people worked for bear hunting. And another concern is how much money the province spends each year on complex hunting regulations. So it seems obvious that, hey, let's focus more on bear watching than bear hunting. But unfortunately, Ministry of Forest spokesperson said the ministry is disappointed in the report, claiming that the study creates an artificial divide between bear viewing and hunting, which are not necessarily mutually exclusive activities.
You know, I kind of have to agree there because I don't know, hunters say that they enjoy hunting because they enjoy nature. So if they enjoy nature so much, actually, they should enjoy watching the animals instead. Just, you know, in all of their glory out in nature and not having to shoot them, if that is the case.
Well, yeah, and for me, it makes sense that they are exclusive because if we hunt all the bears and shoot them, then there'll be none to watch. So they are mutually exclusive. They are interconnected, sorry. So that is out of BC. So I think that is good news. So hopefully that'll change some laws and help people to open their eyes to see that hunting is costing us money and it's not good for tourism. And this is good out of New Zealand. New Zealand bans shark finning. So the decision to ban shark finning, I know, awesome, has been called a great victory by the Green Party. The government decided to ban the practice and tighten the timetable for eradicating shark finning in New Zealand waters. So just like most laws, it's not happening just yet, but it'll happen in October 2014 and fight with the first trench. So I guess they have different types of species that they're going to slowly stop. And then with blue sharks stopping in October 2016, which is unfortunate because blue sharks are becoming more rare. So the Green Party there is trying to make the ban a little bit sooner.
You said 2014.
It starts in 2014, but they kind of have it like...
They have to taper it off.
Taper it off, exactly.
Because you can't just stop it. Killing them right away, because what would happen? All those sharks would live.
They might thrive.
They might, yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's a stepwise approach, but I think it's great. And I love that the Green Party is just backing this. And, you know, I think it's amazing. And this means that New Zealand will join 100 countries and states, including Australia, the EU, and the US. Unfortunately, our country, Canada, is not on that
list. Not on that list yet. It's coming.
No, and it will be coming thanks to activists working very hard to have those laws changed. Speaking of local activists in Vancouver, the Vancouver Animal Defense League and their fur campaigns have been in the local news lately. The Vancouver Animal Defense League is calling a victory after Grouse Mountain decided not to reorder their winter line jackets with real fur. They say that Grouse Mountain has removed all cruel fur products from its retail operations immediately after they announced an anti-fur protest that was going to be held on January 7th. However, Grouse Mountain told Global News that the two brands of fur-trimmed coats that they sold extremely well and that they're currently out of stock and do not anticipate to reorder this season.
That kind of seems like a contradiction of terms. Yeah, they're doing so well, selling really well, but we won't be getting any more.
Yeah, so they're trying to say that it's not the work of the activists.
Yeah,
so
we just won't be getting any more. Yeah, we don't want to make any money.
They don't want to give it victory. So
it makes me curious, though, what we're going to be next season. So we should probably watch
that's
that.
A good point.
Yeah, there's going to be monitoring of that.
Yeah, so they're monitoring
all
it.
You have to do is announce a protest and they'll stop
they're
selling
scared
it.
Of bad media.
Yeah, they definitely are. Well, and there's one more store that they've been targeting, which is Brooklyn Clothing, which also sells fur trim coats. This is in Vancouver as well, in the high-end area of Yale Town. And they're asking the owner to remove the fur from the stores. However, the owner believes that Canada Goose is an ethical company and one of the most socially conscious... Sorry, he says it's one of the most socially conscious companies that he deals with.
We had an interview about that recently, right, Jackie?
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to check that out, that was in December.
Yeah. Don't remember the date, but it's December. Called The Ferocious something.
Yeah, yeah, The Ferocious. It's The Ferocious World, yes. And that's on animalvoices.org. Thank you so much for the news. For our feature interview today, we have Dr. Jennifer Mather on the show to talk to us about octopuses. She is a leading researcher on these animals, concentrating on their behavior and personalities, and has been publishing articles on cephalopods since 1978. While she is a professor of psychology now at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Dr. Mather grew up in Victoria on Vancouver Island, where she acquired her lifelong fascination with cephalopods. She prefers to do field research and has done so in a variety of locations, including Bermuda, Hawaii, and the Caribbean. Dr. Mather has explored theoretical ideas in areas such as octopus foraging strategies, personalities, intelligence, and consciousness. Hello, Dr. Mather, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to talk to us about the strange and mysterious world of octopuses, at least to us. You have a vast amount of knowledge about these creatures, but for the rest of us, because they live in the ocean and we live on the land, it's safe to say that most people don't have much of a clue what the lives of these animals are all about, and they would be surprised to know about what makes them so special in the areas of intelligence, for example. So this is Octopuses 101 for us today, and I'd like to start very basic. What exactly is an octopus? What is a cephalopod?
Okay. Simply, they are mollusks, which means they're related to snails and clams. Cephalopods are mollusks without shells. Now, if you think of a snail, everybody talks about snails as slow and unreactive. And what's happened to the cephalopods is that they've kept the basic sort of structure of being a mollusk, but they have got rid of the shell, and they have got fast, and they have got good vision, and they have got good movement capacity. So somebody once described them as racing snails.
Wow. That information alone is fascinating to me. So thank you for that. I didn't even know that at all. What do they eat?
Most of the octopuses are reasonably unselective. They'll go for a wide variety of clams, crabs, snails. I was doing the study in Bonaire, and we actually monitored what they were eating, because what they do is they go out to find the food, and they come back to their home, and then they eat it, and then they throw away the shell, so you can figure out what they're eating.
Right.
And we actually found 90 species over a couple of years. So they eat a lot of different stuff.
And can you talk about some traits that makes the octopus such a unique creature, even among all the other ocean dwellers? For example, I know that they have blue blood and three hearts. You don't see that every day.
That's true. On the other hand, I think the more interesting thing to think about is that they have a movement system that has no bones.
Okay. Tell us
about
that.
And when you think about it, when you say, well, how can you move without bones? And people say, oh, never thought about that. And then I point out to them that the human tongue has no bones.
I guess right. Though, but you don't think about your tongue moving too far from out of your mouth. So how is it that they move? Like, they have a jet propulsion system too, so they have a few different ways of moving, right?
That's right. They have a jet propulsion system, so clearly they can go off jet propelled through the water. But what's probably more important is that they have 8 arms, and each one of these arms can do something separately, or they could do something completely together. Okay. Underneath the arms, they have a row of suckers, which are basically suction cups. Mm-hmm. They can move just one of these, or they can move all of them. And they have a wonderful movement that I call conveyor belt, where they pick up something little with the end of one extended arm, and then they pass it from sucker to sucker to sucker to the mouth.
That's
really interesting, movement control.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me, too. Everything you're saying is fascinating. They're just such a unique creature. And I understand, too, their suction cups, they can taste what they're touching with their suction cups. How does that work?
Well, they've got receptors. I mean, you've got receptors on your tongue, and they've got receptors on their suckers. As a matter of fact, flies have chemical receptors in their feet. So they taste stuff by stepping in it, which I also find fascinating. Another thing about the octopuses is that they have absolutely fantastic camouflage.
Yeah.
An octopus can match the background so that you just don't see it. One of the ways I describe that is saying that octopuses are the real chameleons.
Yeah, in the research I was doing for this interview, I actually saw there was a comparison. It was like this or this. The first picture was a lizard, which, yeah, he was, or a chameleon. He was doing a pretty good job, but you could kind of see the outline of him. And then the next picture was the octopus. What octopus? You couldn't see the octopus. It was amazing. So from what I've read, I've learned that the octopus is a solitary creature, which is also very unusual in the animal kingdom. But of course, there has to be some socialization in their lives in order for them to reproduce. So can you talk a little bit about maybe their social behavior or lack of, and what do their mating rituals entail?
Well, most of the octopuses are solitary. Recently, one of my colleagues started studying an octopus that is found in the Indo-East Pacific that actually does kind of live in groups. And, you know, we don't know much about... They don't have mating rituals, unfortunately. We don't know much about how they find each other. We think what's going on is that the female, when she's mature, is emitting a chemical, and that the male kind of goes, And what's interesting is not so much what they do when they're courting, but what they do when they're mating. The male has a third, okay, they've got eight arms, right?
Right.
If you take the middle of the head and you count 1, 2, 3, 4 left and then 1, 2, 3, 4 right, then you figured out which arm it is, okay? So the third right arm in the males has a groove down the length of the arm and a specialized arm tip. So when he finds a female, what he tries to do is to reach out and touch her and then to reach inside her mantle. And there's something called the oviducal gland. And then he passes a spermatophore, which is not a sperm, but a whole packet of hundreds of thousands of sperm.
Okay.
And he passes that down that groove in his arm and into the oviducal gland. And then somehow or other, the sperm are stored inactivated. And then when she lays eggs, she passes them past the oviducal gland, fertilizes them on the way to be laid, to being laid, which is really very interesting.
That's way more information than I was expecting to hear. Wow, that's certainly, again, they're such a unique animal. And I understand, too, that after mating, that's sort of the end of their life cycles. Can you talk a little bit about their life cycles and how long they live for?
Okay, well, the first thing is that they live a very short period, and one of my colleagues described it as a live fast, die young.
Yeah.
Most of the smaller octopuses live a year, maybe 6 months.
Wow.
The giant Pacific octopus, which is the one that you can go see in the aquarium, which really can get up to 100 pounds, it might live 3 or 4 years. At the end of that, at the end of mating time, the male will die. But at the end of mating time, the female will live for a period between a couple of weeks and 6 months, and she'll tend the eggs. She lays the eggs. She either carries them or lays them in a crevice, and she'll tend them and run her suckers down them and clean them and ventilate them until they hatch, and then she dies.
Wow, that, again, fascinating. You study the cognition and behavior of octopuses, so you must know a bit about how octopuses think, maybe, as much as any human being can know from observation and interaction.
I think as much as anybody knows, but nobody knows very much.
Well, you know more than me, so I think it all starts in the brain, and from what I understand, another interesting fact about the octopus is the octopus has the most advanced neurological system of any invertebrate with large brains. Can you talk about this?
They have a very funny brain design, though. It's made of condensation of ganglia, which are just sort of simple centers that are in the simpler mollusks. So what happened is, through evolution, it came around to the center, and the brain actually wraps around the intestine.
Wow.
Which is sort of inefficient. And then they have nerve cords running down all the arms. And these nerve cords have a fair amount of independence, so you can actually cut an arm off an octopus. Don't do this, but you can.
Right.
And then the arm will crawl down a moistened rock or your moistened hand. So it's got quite a bit of independent communication. And one of the problems is to figure out how much the octopus manages with the central brain and how much it manages just with the arms.
Well, I know that you, Dr. Mather, you're fascinated by octopuses. I'm guessing it might have to do a little bit to do with their intelligence, as we human beings call it. But I take a bit of an issue with applying the word intelligence to non-human animals, as it's a word that is usually measured by us in our own human terms, what's intelligent for us, which might not be intelligent for a non-human animal. But when people say that octopuses are intelligent, what is meant by that? And can you give us some examples of octopus intelligence?
Sure. I would say that intelligence is the ability to adapt your behavior to circumstances, to learn, to use the things you've learned in new situations. So in that sense, you don't have to say, well, gee, that's our definition, because it's okay. You can use that definition across a whole bunch of animals. They explore. They navigate across the rocky bottom of the ocean, and then they come back home to a place where they hide. So that means they've got spatial memory, and they're figuring out where they are and where they need to go. And it's interesting that they explore, because what that means is when they come to a new area, and we underestimate animals. A lot of animals do this. They don't just do something because they are set up for a particular circumstance. They go explore so they can find out what's in the neighborhood, so that they can use it later. Now, octopuses also take jar lids off jars, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, we have a video of that on our website, actually. That was cool when I saw that.
Yeah. They also use tools. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have to be intelligent to use tools. Nonetheless, it's really quite interesting, because they're hiding in the home. No, actually, the best story of the tools is not mine, but it's somebody else's. They found that they had octopuses that were going out in sandy, muddy areas, and there wasn't really any place to hide. So some of them would dig out separated coconut halves. They'd carry them underneath their web. They'd go off hunting and foraging and all this kind of stuff, and then they'd take the shells out from under their web, open them up, crawl inside, pull them together, and hide in them.
They are learning, as you're saying, how to how to adapt to their environment, take what's in their environment and adapt it to their needs.
Right, but if you think about this example, if you think about my example of bringing the rocks back to block your home,
right,
or this particular example of a coconut shell, they must have been thinking ahead.
And they're thinking of their survival, they're thinking of their defense.
That's right.
Yeah.
But they're not just thinking about now. This is what makes it thinking. They're not just reacting to what's happening now. They're estimating what will happen in the future and taking action that will make them better in the future.
So why do you think it is that octopuses have developed this cognitive ability that we're just so fascinated with, that, wow, they can think in the future and act towards that in terms of what will protect them in their environment?
Right, because when we think about it, we normally think that intelligence is used in social situations. Mm-hmm. If you think about where they live, and particularly where they evolve probably in the coral reef areas, in warm oceans. And if you don't have a shelter, like the mollusks did, then anybody can get you, okay?
Yeah.
So what they have to do is what we call foraging under the risk of predation. They have to figure out what the food might be. They have to figure out where it is. They have to figure out what it is. They have to figure out what to do with it. But they have to keep an eye out for the fish, the crabs, the marine mammals, anything that's trying to get them. And it's actually a very complicated situation. So I think they developed their intelligence, and I describe it as a foraging theory of intelligence. They developed their intelligence in order to survive in a changing and varied environment.
That definitely makes sense. In my research, I even read that just really aware of their environment, they have even been known to board fishing boats and open holds to eat crabs. Like, that is really just, it just seems like they're being a lot more aggressive and dynamic than the average sea-dwelling creature would be, just to venture out of their normal environment like that. And on that note, too, I'm just curious, how long can octopuses stay out of the water? Because I've read about this several times, of them getting out of their tanks, their aquariums, for example, and going across the room and then coming back and going back home. Like, how long can they do that for?
And by the way, I was studying these animals in Bermuda, and I watched one chasing a crab, and there was a rock sticking up out of the water.
Oh, my goodness.
And when you chase a crab on the land, it goes into the water. When you chase it in the water, it goes on the land. So this guy came up and came up on the top of the rock, and the octopus simply followed it up over, out of the water onto the rock. It depends on the species. I know Jim Cosgrove, who worked for the Royal BC Museum for many years, used to transport octopuses back to aquariums by having damp, I don't know, gunny sacks or something like that, dampened with salt water over them. And I think he thought that they could live quite nicely for about half an hour.
Okay.
I don't think most species could, but
yeah.
A while.
Half an hour is longer than a fish, for example. Well, I'm interested in knowing about any personal interactions that you yourself may have had with octopuses. Have they been curious to interact with you? And in your studies of their personalities, what have you discovered?
Okay, well, the answer to the first question is scientists are usually pretty careful to stay away from the animals because we want their natural behavior. But I can remember once we were watching, you know, half-hour watches, I think, and I was watching an octopus that was about 2 feet away from me, and it was sitting at the edge of its home, and I was holding on to a knob of rock so that I wouldn't get washed by the waves and stuff. And the octopus, and I had a dive glove on, the octopus took off from its home, swam over to me, sat down on my hand, and explored my hand with its arms, which I found quite exciting.
Wow.
And after about 30 seconds, I think it decided that I didn't taste very good, and it went back.
Because he was tasting you with his suckers.
Really,
wow.
Yeah.
You could have been a meal for him had he liked how you tasted.
Well, another thing that happened in that same place, sometimes they're in quite shallow water. They were there. And I was watching an octopus, and I was standing with my dive mask sort of peering down at the sandy environment underneath, okay? And this octopus came foraging along, and it came down, and it came and it felt underneath my dive flippers.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to say to him, hey, I'm sorry, there's nothing there.
Well,
I couldn't do that.
And you know, I've read of other cases where octopuses they are curious. Like the difference that I see with these animals is they're pretty brave and I guess I don't know if aggressive is outgoing. Like they will go out and, as you said, explore. They'll go out and explore their environment. And I've heard of them just sort of before feeling other human beings and just sort of wanting to explore. Like, what is this human being about? And then I didn't even realize, as you said, they were probably seeing, like, how does this person taste? Wow, that's just really interesting.
Yeah.
To conclude, what can we humans learn from octopuses as the unique creatures that they are? And you are a psychologist, so you probably have some really special insights into this.
Well, I would say that some of the things that we can learn is we can learn how movement systems work. Because there really aren't, I mean, I've heard it said, though I've never seen it, that an octopus could actually tie a knot in its arm and run it down the arm. So figuring
cool.
it, and that has the potential for robots.
Yeah.
But the other thing that's interesting is that since they have a completely different kind of intelligence than we have, then we can get an idea of the theoretical idea of what intelligence is, how it evolved, and what it's good for. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about all us mammals, we're all related, but the octopus is completely different. And I actually did a long-distance presentation for the people from CT, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, mm-hmm. because they were interested in thinking about not just what our intelligence is, but how intelligence might evolve for any animal that we might find somewhere out in the void.
So, yeah, definitely. I mean, you would never think that you could learn that from an octopus if you didn't know any better. And so that's why I actually wanted to have you here on the show today. You really have enlightened us with just this 20 minutes of information about octopuses, and I thank you for that. You have co-authored a book. It's called Octopus, the Ocean's Intelligent Invertebrate. So I encourage people to go out and read that if they want to learn more. Thank you very much for coming on the show today, Dr. Mather, to talk to us about the mysterious, or maybe not so mysterious anymore, world of octopuses. Have a good day.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in the downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories in British Columbia, Canada. Next week's show, I believe, is going to be a bit of a surprise, so stay tuned for that. And we here at Animal Voices Show modestly ask you to keep connected with us via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, liking our Facebook page. And join us on Twitter's at Animal Voices YVR. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com by email. And also please check out our website, animalvoices.org, where our shows can be downloaded. And if you appreciate the work that we do at Animal Voices every week to bring you original quality programming, please support the show by making a donation to us at Animal Voices at Co-op Radio, because we do rely on your donations to keep the show on the air. To make a donation, go to coopradio.org and click on Donate to Co-op Radio, and remember to indicate on your donation that it is going towards Animal Voices. We are closing the show today by a cover song of the Beatles' Octopus's Garden, performed by Leah Erb. And stay tuned for now for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. And thank you so much for listening, and please be kind to the animals.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. Octopus's garden in the shade.